Get right back into our lectures here. Just did one digression as to some of Jesus' background, the roles he would have assumed as firstborn son, and then becoming essentially the patriarch of the family. Now I want to take another digression, different one, but also to help us understand some of the flavor and what's going on here. Let's take a closer look at what the occupation of Joseph and Jesus likely was. Let's notice Matthew 13. This isn't in chronological order. We're jumping way ahead, but I want to bring this out. This, again, is something I wasn't sure when to bring it up, but this is probably as good a time as any. Matthew 13, verses 54, 55. And when he, Jesus, had come to his own country, he taught them in their synagogue, so that they were astonished and said, "Where did this man get this wisdom and these mighty works? Is this not the carpenter's son?" And for years, we've all heard the story, seen the pictures and so on of Jesus and his father Joseph being carpenters, working in a carpenter's shop and so on. Also, Mark 6 and verse 3, speaking of Jesus, is this not the carpenter? And as I talked about several lectures ago, in that culture, a son learned whatever his father's trade was. If his father was a potter, he became a potter. If his father is a metalsmith, he became a metalsmith. If the father's a farmer, the sons would become farmers and so on. So it was very, very common it would actually have been very unusual for a son to choose a different line of work than what the father did. They would learn their craft, their occupation at the father's side growing up. I actually did myself. I may mention that a little bit later. But what is this word carpenter in Greek is the Greek word tekton, T-E-K-T-O-N, which means not carpenter, but a builder or a craftsman, a builder or a craftsman. Now, when the King James Version translators 400 years ago, when they translated the Hebrew and the Greek into the King James Bible, the first authorized English language Bible we had, they saw this Greek word meaning builder, and they substituted carpenter. Well, why did they do that? None of the King James translators had ever been to the Holy Land, living in England. If you're a builder in England 400 years ago, what do you build with?
Wood.
You build with wood, because England's covered with trees then. They saw this word builder, not having been to the Holy Land, they automatically substitute carpenter because that's what builder meant to those King James translators. That was the building material that everybody used. And every English language translation since then has followed the lead of the King James Version. It is my personal opinion, but I'm not unique in this. A number of other scholars, some of whom I have met and personally talked with, I'm picking this up from them. King James translators translate tekton as carpenter, somebody who builds with wood. But what was the building material in Galilee in the first century? Yes, Nathan.
Stone.
Stone. And you go to Israel around Galilee, and all of the towns you pass through, actually just about everywhere in Israel for that matter, everything is built of either stone or concrete because there are not a lot of trees that grow there, and there certainly aren't a lot of trees that are suitable for building wood. I mentioned earlier, you know, you look out at our trees here, you have these nice, you know, 60, 70 foot tall, very straight trees. You don't have that in Israel. You have scrub oak trees, which are very gnarly and twisted. You have olive trees that are the same way. The only tall straight trees you have in Israel are the date palm trees, but you don't use those for building material because they're fruit trees. They bear the fruit, so you don't use those. So the common building material wasn't wood there, it was stone, which you see to this day. Builders were people who worked with stone, not with wood. Wood was scarce. Okay, so this is a reconstruction of a first century house, a common type house there, and the building material was stone. There's plenty of stone. Some of you have been there to Israel, been there multiple times, and there's just stone everywhere. So it was very common, very cheap, locally available material. So they would stack stones like this, and then they would cover them with plaster, which is a mixture of clay, pulverized rock. The walls would have actually looked quite a bit like our plastered walls here, our sheetrocked walls. So they would cover the stones with plaster like this, so they'd be fairly smooth. So this is what the typical inside of a house would have looked like. They did use some wood. They would have used wood for rafters, for door frames, generally above the heading of the door, like here, although here's one that is stone here and then one of wood over here. So they would have used some wood. Doors would have been made out of wood. They had openings for windows, but they did not have glass windows, at least the common people. The upper crust did, around this time, glass windows were starting to be introduced by the Romans. So they would have used wooden shutters to cover the windows to keep the wind from coming in during cold weather. They would have had wooden doors and so on. So there would have been some carpentry work as we would know it. So Jesus, being a tecton, being a builder, is probably somebody who works more with stone than anything. They would have done some work with wood for rafters, for doors, for things like that, but generally a builder is somebody who builds with stone at that time. And again, this isn't my idea. It's a number of scholars are coming to that conclusion. I've actually heard one of them actually explain that yes, the translators know this, but it messes up the story if they translate it from carpenter to stonemason. Yes, question here.
Is there another word that would be closer to carpenter that they would have like?
No, there's not.
So is it still technically, it's more of those like what we're
It could mean carpenter, and if the word tecton, and if it were in an area where that was very heavily wooded.
More likely.
Yeah, it would be in appropriate words, but it's a matter of what building material was available that was commonly used in that time. So yeah, good question there. Another thing, there are actually in Nazareth, they found remains of many stone quarries for limestone there. Here's a typical one. Actually, if you know what you're looking for, all over Israel you see a lot of stone quarries. The whole area is limestone, this whitish, yellowish, whitish rock about the color of the walls here. And here's an old stone quarry there from Nazareth. They found remains of a number of those from the first century. And all of the villages, towns, ruins you see all around that area, Capernaum, Bethsaida, Cana, Nazareth, all of these towns, they're all built with stone. That's just what they use there. And not just there, but Jerusalem, all around that area as well. So the kind of builders that Jesus and Joseph, his stepfather, were probably not carpenters. They probably would have done some woodwork, like rafters, again, doors, but they are most likely stonemasons. Do we see any indications of that in Scripture? Well, I think we do with that background. Let's notice 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 10. Where Paul writes, according to the grace of God, which was given to me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation and another builds on it. So Paul here describes himself as a master builder, an architecton. Architecton. Recognize an English word in there. Architect. Master builder. It's where we get our word architect. But a master builder does not build a foundation out of wood, because why? Build a foundation out of wood and it's going to rot within a couple of years and your foundation is going to be gone. No, you build a foundation out of stone, or today concrete is what is used. So this is a clear indication that a tecton is somebody who doesn't build with wood but with stone. The master builder, the architecton. The builder is tecton, master is architecton. So he lays the foundation with stone, not with wood. Yes, Charlie?
Well, as the foundation that Paul is building on, Jesus is the chief cornerstone.
Yes.
As the foundation that we build on.
Right, and another builds on it. Who's The overall builder is Jesus Christ, of course, but he's talking about other fellow ministers who are building as well. Let's look at another passage. This one I think is more intriguing, 1 Peter 2, verses 4 and 5. Notice Peter is writing this, and who is Peter? Peter is probably knows Jesus better than any of the disciples. They were obviously very close. He's the one who is right there with Jesus all the time. And notice what he says here, breaking into the sentence, we are coming to him, Jesus Christ, as to a living stone. He's calling Christ a living stone, who was rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious. So he says Jesus is himself the stone, the cornerstone, as Charlie just mentioned there. Now notice this, you also as living stones, Christ is a living stone, you also, writing to the church, you are living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. So he says a couple of things here. Christ is the living stone, the rejected stone. The analogy he's using there, the metaphor he's using is a stonemason. If a stonemason is shaping a stone and it cracks, what happens to that stone? Well, it's useless. It's got to be thrown out or chiseled into a smaller stone and reused in a different way, but it's rejected by the builders if it's cracked or weak or inferior or something like that. But he says, you, as living stones, are being built into a house. The church members are being built into a house, a spiritual temple. Who's the one building the spiritual temple out of stones? Jesus Christ is. So he's using the metaphor of Jesus being the stonemason, building a spiritual house, which is his church, out of us as the stones. We're the building material. But we're likened to stones there. So would Peter say this if Jesus were a carpenter working with wood? I don't see it. The story, the analogy breaks down. But it fits perfectly if he knows that Jesus is a stonemason. And just as he was a physical stonemason working with physical stones, he is now working with spiritual stones, which is the body of his church. He is building into a spiritual temple there, being built into a spiritual house. So who is the stonemason? Jesus Christ, building his own spiritual house there. Nowhere in the Bible do we see an analogy or a metaphor of Jesus building with wood, but we do see a metaphor of him building with stones as a stonemason, with us as the stones. And I think Peter uses this metaphor because he knows that is what Jesus was a stonemason. Here's a photograph of, from modern times of somebody building a stone house there in northern Israel. You can see the techniques, the methods used there. Yeah, and in conclusion, I think this is what Jesus is, that he is a stonemason. And this also means that he is a very rugged man, a very strong man, one with strong hands, strong muscles from lifting stones, working with stones, this kind of thing. And I think that plays out in the next part of the story that we'll be covering, which is his encounter with the money changers there in Jerusalem. And nobody tries to stop him because he is probably a very strong, he is a very strong, very obviously physically fit man, and they don't want to take him on. They don't want to take him on. Now, having said all of that, can I prove that Jesus was a stonemason? No, I can't. The Bible does not explicitly spell that out, but it also doesn't explicitly spell out he's a carpenter either. But I think all the evidence considered, Peter's use of the metaphor of Jesus being a stonemason, building his spiritual temple, his spiritual house out of stones. Had the King James translators lived in Galilee when they translated that, it's obvious they would have translated it as stonemason instead of carpenter there, just based on the material that was available for a builder to use. Any questions about that before we continue on with the story? Again, there are more and more scholars, this is starting to pop up in a number of things these days that I come across. 10, 12, 15 years ago, you never heard anybody talk about this, but now people are realizing, hey, this actually makes a lot more sense when we consider the background and what's going on there in the first century. Okay, if there are no questions, we'll continue on with the first cleansing of the temple on page 13, John 2, verses 13 through 22. Now, the Passover of the Jews was at hand. Again, John uses Passover of the Jews. He's, again, writing to a universal audience, explaining just very, very briefly, the Passover is one of the celebrations kept by the Jews, and this is why Jesus goes to Jerusalem. The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. He's going up again by describing the terrain, not the direction. And he found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves and the money changers doing business. When he had made a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen and poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. And he said, verse 16, and he said to those who sold doves, take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of merchandise. I have something I want to pass around with you here. This is something that always gets students' attention, and that's money. I have here a little first century imitation coin bag and the types of coins that would have been used. But I'll pass it around, let all of you just take a look at those. Most of these are reproductions of coins from the first century. There are some authentic ones in there. There are some that I've been told are authentic, but I strongly suspect are fakes because I've bought them from different vendors over the years. But this kind of gives us an idea of what's going on here. Now, earlier in talking about John the Baptizer and John, although John is a priest, his father, Zechariah, is a priest, but John is not functioning at the temple in Jerusalem. John is down in the desert, as I talked about earlier. He's kind of the anti-priest because the priesthood in the first century had become very, very corrupt. And this is where we really get into seeing some of this. So what is going on here that causes Jesus to react in such a forceful manner, to overturn the tables and to cast them out? Well, to understand what's going on, we need to talk about some background that is not spelled out in the Gospels. We know it's there because of Jesus' actions, but what exactly is going on? We understand this from some other historical sources. Give a little historical background leading up to this. This is in the period between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament, about 400 years there of history that we don't have recorded in the Bible. Some of it is recorded prophetically, but there's this big gap. And during that time, Alexander the Great arises. He takes over the Holy Land. He dies, his empire is divided among four of his generals and so on. We're familiar with that history. There's the period of the Maccabees, and I don't know if you've covered any of this in your other classes or not, but I'm just giving you a quick overview here. There's a period of the Maccabees where the Jews revolt and overthrow the Syrian rulers. Antiochus Epiphanes and the festival of Hanukkah plays into this, 167 BC. The Jews regain their independence for a period there. However, there's a series of high priests in there who are not of the line of Aaron, which is where the high priest is supposed to come from, supposed to be a descendant of Aaron. So during this period, and later when Herod the Great becomes king over this area in 37 BC, they start selling the office of high priest. It's no longer a hereditary position. They start selling the position of high priest to the highest bidder. And for the period of about 60 years before and after Christ's ministry, on average, there's a new high priest every other year. Some years, there's more than one. So there's this incredibly high turnover when the high priest is supposed to be a hereditary lifetime position. But the Romans have discovered, and Herod has discovered, that by selling the office of the high priest, you can generate a lot of money from that. So that is what is going on, and become very corrupted by this time. So those involved in the scheme have, to them, a good thing going financially, at least for themselves. They sell the office of the high priest, so Herod and his Roman backers get the money from the person who's bid for the position. So no doubt a lot of that money gets skimmed off as it goes all the way back to Rome and the Roman emperor there. So they make money. Everybody up the chain from Herod all the way back to Rome is getting a cut of this bribe for selling the office of the high priest. So the person who bids for the office of high priest, what's in it for them? What do they get out of it? Well, we know that they, by doing that, they can control everything that's going on at the temple. And there's a lot of money going on. Here's an illustration of a house in Jerusalem. Here's the temple over here. This is looking across the Tyropian Valley. The Western Wall today is right down here at the base of this. But this high priest, they think it's the high priest's house, was destroyed in 70 AD. It has been excavated. You can go and visit it today in Jerusalem. It's a very lavish house. They actually call it the priestly mansion, because that's what it is. It's a mansion. It has these beautiful mosaic tile floors, multi-story building. I think it's three stories, if I remember correct. It's been 20 years since I've been there. But very, very elaborate, very ornate. Here's one of those stone pots that I talked about earlier. They found remains of that there. Beautifully painted walls there. They have found remains of that. Just, again, a mansion. So the priestly class, the upper crust of the high priest, were very wealthy because they were able to control everything that was going on at the temple. And what was going on? Well, John specifically mentions here two things. He mentions the money changing and the selling of animals for sacrifice, specifically doves and sheep and oxen. So what's going on with these activities? While we're passing around the money, let's talk about that first. Money changing. I just noticed yesterday as I was passing through the airport to come here, the going rate for exchange of money at an airport is, let's see, I think it was about 8% fee that to charge to change your dollars into euros or vice versa. So what is significant? Well, people, you can read Acts, first couple of chapters of Acts, where the day of Pentecost comes, and people are coming from all over the Roman world to Jerusalem, coming from Babylon, from Egypt, from North Africa, from Macedonia, from Asia Minor. They're all coming to Jerusalem for Pentecost, and they're bringing their own local currencies from whatever countries or regions that they came from. So people are bringing coins from all over the Roman Empire and beyond. So when they come to Jerusalem, they are bringing their own local coins, local currency, like the ones being passed around here. The Roman Empire had its own standard coinage, and there's examples of that in there, but some of these areas had their own locally minted coins as well. So just as if you were traveling to Europe or Japan or somewhere, these days, you would have to change your dollars to other local currency. The same type of thing is taking place at the temple. You'd have to change your local coins for the official temple coin, which was the Tyrian half shekel. There's one of them in the bag being passed around. It's about the size of a quarter. It's the bright silver coin. This is what it looks like. It was called a Tyrian shekel because it's minted at that time at the city of Tyre, which is on the Mediterranean coast in what is today Lebanon. And on one side is the god Melkart, and on the other side is this eagle here. Since the Jews were not allowed to mint their own coins by Rome, the priests determined that the Tyrian half shekel was the official temple coin. because it had the highest silver, the most pure silver content. They would kind of do the same thing back then. They would dilute their silver with tin and other metals to cheapen it. But the Tyrian coins were noted for their pure silver content. They're like 98.9% pure silver there. So whenever somebody came to give a temple offering, it had to be done in this, had to be converted into this Tyrian half shekel. So what happened? Well, they go to the money changers and they get ripped off. Instead, they bring their coins in there, and instead of getting a one-to-one equivalent, depending on the source you read, instead of a small markup fee of maybe 3 to 5%, something like that, their fee, according to some sources, was up to 100%. So you give the equivalent of $100 to the temple, they're only going to give you 50 for it. You basically get ripped off to the tune of about 100%. Again, depending on the sources, we don't have it exactly spelled out, but this seems to be about what was going on, that they're basically charging about 100% fee to convert your local coins into the official temple coin, which was the only valid one to pay the temple tax every year that is required there. So this is part of what the money changers are doing. And this is why Jesus is so incensed, because they're stealing from the people there. Now, a similar thing was happening with the animals that are being brought in for sacrifice. People would come to Jerusalem with an animal that they had raised from birth, perhaps a lamb there, that they're going to bring for Passover or for one of the other sacrifices. And of course, the animal had to be without blemish. So the priests, who are a part of this Jerusalem religious establishment, hypothetically, let's just say they have to inspect the lamb to make sure it is without blemish. So they could do something like, well, Samuel, I see you've brought your lamb here all the way from Galilee, and it's a nice-looking lamb, but unfortunately it has this wart here on its back leg, so it is impure. It has a blemish. It cannot be offered. Or it has a scratch here, a scar on its leg. It has a blemish. I'm sorry. You cannot offer this lamb. But we make you a special deal. We will sell you an official lamb with a temple stamp of approval. Yes, it costs 5 times as much as the normal going rate for a lamb, but it is pure. It is a great honor to be able to offer such a fine lamb to God. So they would reject the people's sacrifices that are brought and sell them an animal for 4 or 5 times the going rate for a sacrificial animal. And they are, again, ripping the people off. They are stealing from the people. So how do the priests benefit from that? Well, the priests control the concessions for which animals are sold at the temple. They contract with the vendors to supply the pigeons, the doves, the sheep, the bulls, the things like that. They control, they sell the concession for the money changers. They get a cut of all of this. And the high priest at the very top of the chain gets cuts of all of this. So that's why they would bid for the position, because they know they can get a cut of all of these other businesses, the sacrifices, the money changing, all of this that is going on at the temple. So the people are getting ripped off and the priests are getting rich. And this is the background for what happens when Jesus cleanses the temple. And when he cleanses the temple, what does he call them? He says, "My Father's house shall be called a house of worship for all nations, but you have made it a den of thieves." So Jesus knows exactly what they're doing. They're a den of thieves. They're robbing and stealing from the people. And that is why he is so incensed and angry as he is. So the priests, who are supposed to lead the people to God, they're supposed to be examples of righteousness, are complicit in actually stealing from the people who are coming there just to worship God. And that is why Jesus calls it a den of thieves, because it has become an established system built around stealing from the people who are coming to the temple to worship God. So when Jesus comes along and he does this, what's he doing? Well, he's threatening their power. He's threatening to upset the system. And what do they do? And we see it play out 3.5 years later when they kill him. They conspire to kill him because he's a threat to their power. He's a threat to everybody's power. And they want to hold on to that power. They want to hold on to that income. Question for you here. John here is the only one who records this. And he has this account of Jesus cleansing the temple at Passover at the beginning of Christ's ministry. But Matthew, Mark, and Luke have Jesus cleansing the temple at the end of Christ's ministry, the last Passover. Why would that be? What's going on here? A lot of people, again, this is what classic examples say, well, the gospel writers don't agree. One of them, John, puts it at the beginning of the ministry, the others put it at the end. Obviously, they disagree. We can't believe them. It's all made up. It's all fabricated. Why the discrepancy there, or is there a discrepancy? The critics say, yeah, this is an obvious discrepancy. They've got it at, you know, 3.5 years apart, or 3 years apart. Yes, Kayla.
Has it been suggested that he cleansed the temple twice?
Yes. Did he cleanse the temple twice? Yeah, that is our position, that yes, he does it twice. It's just that Matthew, Mark, and Luke do not record this one. Only John records the first one, whereas they record it at the end. John, writing later after Matthew, Mark, and Luke, doesn't see a need to mention it again because he's already got it there at the beginning of Christ's ministry. So yeah, apparently he does it twice, cleanses the temple twice. You might say, I think this is a good way to look at it, that the first time Jesus is kind of sending a warning shot across the bow of them, that this is what his ministry is about. It's about purity. It's about cleanliness. It's about getting right with God. That if you're a religious leader, stop stealing from the people. Kind of sending a warning shot. This is his ministry. This is what he's about. As the Son of God, as Emmanuel, as God in the flesh. And he does this at the beginning, and then at the end of the ministry, by this time it's very obvious what is going on, that they are actively plotting to kill him, to have him murdered, legally executed there. So at the end, he just piles it on at the very end to make it very clear what his motivations are in contrast to their motivations. His motivation is to give his life for all people, and their motivation is to steal as much as they can from the people. At the end, I think at the beginning, he's firing a warning shot, and at the end, the hatred is being piled on, and he's drawing such a contrast between himself, what his ministry is all about, as opposed to what their ministry is all about. His way of serving people versus their way of serving people, which is stealing from them, to be blunt. And there's a vast gulf there between the two of them. Continuing on then with the story, verse 17, wrapping up this story here. Then his disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house has eaten me up." And as we, this is kind of thrown in here, but it's thrown in here because it's a remez. It's a remez. A hint or a clue to look back at something that is written earlier. And this is a quote from Psalm 69 and verse 9. "Because the zeal for your house has eaten me up." And we won't read for lack of time. We don't have time to go through all of Psalm 69, but Psalm 69 is a prophetic psalm about the Messiah's suffering during the crucifixion. About his suffering during the crucifixion. And we do actually find portions of this psalm quoted by the Gospels, such as Psalm 69 and verse 4. "Those who hate me without a cause are more than the hairs of my head." First part of that is quoted in John 15, verse 25. Also Psalm 69, verse 21. "They also gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink," fulfilled in Matthew 27:34, Mark 15:23 and 36, and in Luke 23:36. So you can read the rest of this psalm on your own some other time, but the entire psalm is a prophecy of the Messiah suffering during his last hours as he is imprisoned than as he is crucified. So why, though, would John include this remez here at this point where Jesus overturns the money changers' temples and so on at the beginning of Christ's ministry? Well, my answer to that would be just as John earlier shows the conflict and the tension between John the Baptizer and the religious authorities who come to check him out, find out what he's up to. I think what John is doing here is kind of showing what is to come, that he's showing the conflict between Jesus and the Jerusalem religious establishment and how that is ultimately going to play out. How is it ultimately going to play out? It's ultimately going to play out by those with the power win, by having Jesus executed, as foretold by David in the psalm written 1,000 years earlier. And I think that's the point that John is making. He's pointing, he's kind of doing an unusual thing here. He's pointing his readers back to what David had foretold 1,000 years earlier in this psalm about the suffering of the Messiah in his execution and imprisonment. But he's also pointing forward toward the end of Christ's life. It's going to happen 3 years from this point when this psalm is going to be fulfilled. So I think John interjects this here both to look back as a remez, but also to look forward as to where this is going to end, where the zeal for your house has eaten me up, where that's going to be fulfilled ultimately. It's an unusual remez, and then it points backwards toward what David wrote 1,000 years earlier, but also looking forward prophetically to what would happen with Jesus Christ's execution. Continuing, verse 18, "So the Jews answered and said to him, 'What sign do you show to us since you do these things?' And Jesus answered and said to them, 'Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up.' Then the Jews said, 'It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days?' Now, Herod had actually begun building the temple in the year 20 or 19 BC, and it was still being built and expanded on at this point, 46 years later. In fact, it would still be under construction, not necessarily talking about the literal temple itself, but all of the outer buildings and porches and colonnades and all of that. It was actually not finished until just a few years before 70 AD when the whole thing is destroyed. So it was actually under construction for a very long time. And verse 21, "But Jesus was speaking of the temple of his body." So in Jesus again is doing a rabbi thing. He's making a statement to make them think. Obviously, he's not referring to this huge temple complex that would be rebuilt in 3 days. But he's challenging them to think. He's himself giving a prophecy of his own death and resurrection after 3 days. But obviously they did not get it. And verse 22, "Therefore, when he had risen from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this to them, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had said." Let's see, we are actually... The next part of this is going to be fairly complex, so I'm going to break it off right here for today. So any questions?